For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website. So, good morning. I know some of you were here, but I can't remember. I know everyone wasn't here. About 6 weeks ago when I gave a talk on Yogacara Buddhism and how it pertains to what we think we know. And I'm going to continue my sort of informal study of this today, talking about maybe a slightly different dimension of thought or knowing, you know, relating to how we sort of create and organize our world. And talking about that, again, from a Yogacara perspective. And so for the benefit of people who weren't here for the first talk and for the memory aid to those who were, I will just talk really briefly about what I said before and talk about some key concepts. Yogacara Buddhism is sometimes also known as consciousness-only Buddhism. It is the study of our consciousness, and it arose from early Mahayana school of thinking around the 4th century Common Era. And it really is a way in which people took, you know, what they were able to observe about how they and we think and experience the world, and try to relate that to, you know, kind of a Buddhist understanding of interdependence. And I think it's actually quite profound. And I feel like, you know, that these are things that I can observe in myself, and maybe they're things that you also can observe in yourself. But one of the main points is that as we experience the world, you know, what we actually perceive are images of things in the external world, and they're images that are being transformed by our own consciousness and reflected onto our own mind. You know, what we think we know is often just our interpretation of the events that we see going on around us, not a real reflection of, you know, the external world. And so, you know, because we're all subjects, you know, we're kind of co-creating reality together, and we're generally unaware of how our feelings, our own feelings and experience, are being projected onto the object that we're currently aware of. You know, and we're doing that kind of as because of our own conditioning, which obviously is different for each one of us. We all have had different, you know, life experiences that have taught us all kinds of different aspects of what the world is. We all have different imagination potential, you know, that we imagine different things. And you know, the good news is that although these are really, really pervasive and difficult patterns that are often operating well below our level of awareness, we can actually, you know, slowly change these patterns through deep reflection by observing, you know, the temporary and impermanent and, you know, often illusory nature of our perceptions. And one of the things I talked about is that that's some of what we can use Zazen for. So in terms of, that's sort of the main, you know, idea. There were some particular concepts from Yogacara that Yogacara talks about six sort of consciousnesses that comprise the surface aspects of our mind, and those would be, you know, the five senses: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. Thinking would be the sixth one, which is what we do as we sort of temporarily reflect on objects of mind. They categorize it as one of the surface aspects of the mind, because what they are, within Yogacara, there are also two deeper levels of mind. And these are not exactly thinking, although they do influence our thinking. The first one would be is called manas, which is considered to be sort of the I-making function. It creates the idea of a self that we cling to, as in my past experience, and we are very much, you know, that it is very much a part of us that is not going away. Even if we are able to transform, you know, our relationship to the manas, it's not going away ever. It's part of us. And then the other deeper level of mind is known as alaya vijnana, which is, you know, called the storehouse consciousness in English. And that is an uninterrupted area of mind that retains our actions and experiences. So anything that ever happens to us winds up somewhere buried in the alaya vijnana. And that actually is continually storing, you know, and imprinting our experiences and our memories, almost like, you know, the black box of a flight recorder. And that one really is continuous, whereas the reason that thinking is considered one of the surface aspects of the mind is because thinking is not continuous. There are times when we, you know, in particular, I think when we're asleep, thinking stops. When we faint, when we lose consciousness, when our consciousness is not operating, their thinking is stopping. But the alaya vijnana goes on, and manas is continuing to hold on to, you know, this is my experience. Now, you may say that, well, hold on, you know, when we're sleeping, sometimes we're dreaming. And I think that's okay. I think that that is still the same activity where there is some thinking in that situation, but that is the same activity that's going on when we are awake, in terms of the storehouse consciousness is interacting with the thoughts that we are maybe processing and influencing those thoughts, and our thoughts are then, you know, also influencing the storehouse a little bit and the manas. So although we are trying to make sense of things sometimes in dreams, it's very much a similar process to how these different aspects of our consciousness interact during our daily life. And so, you know, obviously, as we know, it's really difficult to modify our store of experiences. We can't unsee or undo something or unthink something. And all of these things lead to profound difficulties in knowing any given thing as it really is. So this is kind of our human dilemma. And, you know, at the last part of that talk, I talked about how Zazen can become a way of, you know, becoming intimate with your mind and our mind and ourself and environment, that can help see through what it is that is going on, you know, noticing, when we're having a thought, and that thought actually is a judgment about something, not a good, bad judgment, but even just a discernment. And that those are ways of developing a different relationship to this whole process. But, you know, it very much is a process. And it's about seeing how our causes and conditions are operating on us all the time. And so that brings me up to today. And in terms of thinking about how we create and organize our world, I think this way of thinking has huge implications for different areas of our lives. One of the things that maybe I touched on a little bit but didn't really develop much is the understanding that comes from Yogacara Buddhism about how we are habitually transforming images of our world as we perceive it. As I just mentioned, it's you know, partly because of our experience, but it's partly also, and this is, I think, maybe more influenced by the manas aspect of our deeper mind, it's partly a way to cling to the belief that we are an uninterrupted being that goes on, that has our own individual experiences, and our wish to remain in the center of that as the protagonist of this experience. And, you know, also, to a certain extent, our own convenience. We want to, it's natural, it's maybe it doesn't always happen, but it, one thing would be natural for us to hold on to a specific, transform a specific things that are happening to us, because we want to be able to feel good about ourselves. And, you know, if you've ever had a situation where you've tried to ignore that you were maybe rude to someone and, you know, let's forget about it, or maybe I could have a do-over, you know, then I think that that's that kind of situation operating in one's life. Or if you have a sort of habitual feeling about yourself in some area of your life that, you know, I'm horrible at this, I can't do this, or a negative attitude towards some aspect of yourself, that's maybe also a convenient transformation of reality, or an oversimplification of reality. To hold on to, even though it makes you feel bad, it's a way of holding on to a specific fixed view of yourself. And so we're never really able to escape from this process, but we're also never really able to sever ourselves from our environment. We're constantly, you know, interacting with our environment, and in particular, you know, if you think about your daily life, our actions and our behavior are directly related to our interactions with other people. We are constantly maybe modifying something that, you know, how we portray ourselves, or what we relate to other people about ourselves. Because in the thinking that was expressed in the book that I've been reading on Living Yogacara, this is thought to be related to our perception and concern about receiving some kind of social evaluation from other people as good or bad, or, you know, eminent or lowly. And so we're constantly being aware of other people perceiving us, and we're constantly aware of, you know, what effect do our actions have. And so I think about, you know, with respect to karma, we have ways of generating karma, you know, through our actions, maybe. Specifically, you know, the meaning of the word karma is action, and it is ways in which what we do has an effect somewhere. We also generate karma through the mode of speech. You know, we're aware that our words can have particular effects. And I think we're not always quite as aware that we are also generating karma through our mind, through our thoughts. I think we have a tendency to, you know, because our thoughts are accessible only to ourselves, we sometimes think that maybe our thoughts don't really count. You know, maybe it really just matters, you know, that I'm trying to be a good person, and I'm always polite, and you know, I try not to do anything harmful, and I don't step on ants. But actually, all three of these aspects, both our action, you know, our actions and our speech and our thought, are all affecting us. Whether or not anyone else sees them, they're actually impacting on us. And so, you know, if you've ever noticed yourself having a thought about someone like, you know, he doesn't like me, based on something that person did, that really seems like, whoa, he really doesn't like me. Or if you've ever had a thought of, you know, well, she doesn't care. Based on observing that person's actions, you're gonna find yourself responding to that person very differently, in ways that may or may not actually be true. You know, that person they may not like you, they may be having a bad moment, they may be really upset about something else in their life, you know, you can kind of go on and on. But once you have that thought, it really takes on a life of its own in your own, you know, within your own experience, because then you, that you file away that memory in your storehouse as, you know, well, and we start to develop, you know, really habitual views about ourselves or, and or about other people. And so this is, you know, this is sort of the work of our thinking, whether or not it's correct, being stored as a memory in our storehouse consciousness, and it influences our present experience. And so one of the concepts that I really want to sort of highlight today are the ways in which we there are considered to be three subjective transformations as we work with our life experience and process our life experience. And this one is the first subjective transformation of our experience. Things are coming into us, and they're coming in a way that's maybe shaped by our perceptions, shaped by our thinking, and they're being stored in just that way, whether or not they are actually true. They're being stored very subjectively, and that's considered to be the first subjective transformation. You know, we then take whatever is transformed as reality, but as you can see, it's been already subjectively influenced and changed. And so one of the maybe important, you know, sort of cautions, you know, within this way of thinking, is that we really need to be, you know, pretty careful about examining what we believe, so that we can, you know, reorient our lives in a more positive direction. You know, Yogacara is asking us to seek out a way of life that's grounded in recognition and awareness, and not just being mindful for the sake of, you know, this momentary mindfulness, but being mindful because we want to try to be, you know, as accurate as possible and as reflective and thoughtful in what we're making of our experience as possible. So, you know, like I was saying before, you know, with respect to karma, we may believe that if our actions have not been seen by other people, then the matter is over. But the ramifications of all of this negative activity don't disappear. And I will also say that these experiences that we ourselves are subjectively transforming have also been handed down to us through our ancestors. And so there's a way in which we think about our storehouse consciousness as being just unique to ourselves, but actually there is, I think, a larger collective storehouse consciousness that we are all living in and, you know, recreating every generation and enacting over and over and over again, because our family and teachers and friends and people that we've known growing up have taught us that this is the way the world is. And so it's, you know, we think that things are just this way. And so it's very difficult to, and they, you know, received a distorted impression of their own. And so are living according to that. And so these ways of relating to the world are extremely ingrained and very hard to change. And the thing that made me want to talk about this today is actually a recent article I found on NPR. Maybe some of you have seen this. But it really seemed to speak to just this very aspect of the pervasiveness of this whole process of storing information and retrieving it and distorting it and transforming it. And the article that I found came out on August 4th. It was titled, "So You Flunked a Racism Test, Now What?" And I'll just read you a little bit. It says, "You're probably at least a little bit racist and sexist and homophobic. Most of us are. Before you get all indignant, try taking one of the popular implicit association tests. created by social psychologists at Harvard, the University of Washington, and the University of Virginia. They measure people's unconscious prejudice by testing how easy or difficult it is for the test takers to associate words like good and bad with images of black people versus white people, or scientist and lab with men versus women. I actually went online and took one of these tests and you know, was really sort of surprised to you know, discover that how profound this is. And ask me later if you want to know the website. I Googled it and found it and did this. So they go on to say, these tests find that regardless of how many pride parades they attend or how many this is what a feminist looks like t-shirts they own, most people trust men over women, white people over minorities, and straight people over queer people. These trends can hold true regardless of the gender, race, or sexuality of the test taker. So this is a way in which we, whatever demographic role we may have in our society, we were born into this society with these pervasive attitudes. The writer goes on to say, I'm from India, and the test found that I'm biased against Asian Americans. So they go on to say, there's research indicating that these types of implicit prejudices may help explain why cops are more likely to shoot unarmed black men than to shoot unarmed white men, and why employers are more likely to hire white candidates than equally qualified black candidates. So if you, like nearly everybody else, got a worrisome score on the implicit association test, you might be wondering, now what? A few scientists are trying to figure out whether our most deeply rooted prejudices can be rewired, and they're testing out some wild ideas along the way. So I apologize if this is upsetting to anyone. To me, it makes sense as, you know, thinking about how we are just very much steeped in our culture, and maybe one hopeful aspect in thinking about this is, without examining it, we take on our culture's prevailing attitudes, and without questioning, because we're not aware. So I'll just read to you a little bit more. They talk about how researchers at Northwestern University wanted to see if they could remedy racism and sexism during sleep. First, the researchers had 40 volunteers take implicit bias tests like the ones described above to measure how prejudiced the participants were from the start. Then they had everyone go through an anti-bias training program. The volunteers were exposed to images that countered deeply held stereotypes. They saw photos of female faces next to words associated with math or science, like experiment or lab, and black faces paired with pleasant words like sunshine, smile, and honor. Throughout this training, the researchers played a series of sound cues in the background. A specific tone played each time a participant saw an image of a woman paired with a science-related word, and another tone played whenever they saw a picture of a black man alongside positive words. Later, the volunteers took a 90-minute nap. Once everyone was fast asleep, the researchers softly played the same sound cues again to reinforce the day's training. When they woke up, they had no idea what happened while they were sleeping. And when they took the same implicit bias tests after the nap, participants were actually up to 50% less biased. And so it may sound straight out of sci-fi, but it's not all that surprising, actually, given what we know about how the brain works, says Powler. While you're sleeping, he says, your brain goes over what you learned during the day and mashes it up with stuff you already know. And this is very much what I think is, you know, part of what's happening. I think that's also happening while we are awake. And what they found in this test is that by this, you know, pretty simple means, the reductions in implicit bias lasted for up to a week. And so, you know, that may not sound like a lot, but it is an improvement over previous anti-bias training programs. And it also shows that these processes, although they are deeply ingrained, are something that we can manifest. He goes on to say, adults have had years and years of exposure to stereotypes, and biases take hold early. Studies have found that kids as young as 4 or 5 show racial and gender bias. It can take a lot of effort to reverse that. So I found this really intriguing from a you know, kind of a psychological standpoint, but as well a yogacara standpoint. It's very difficult to erase what the authors are referring to as innate bias. Innate in that, you know, I think they're kind of thinking that this is something we're born with. I think it's more something that we are acculturated into, that attitudes that have been given to us by our culture over time. And so what I would say is that, you know, one of the things that maybe practice can help with is in examining ways that we reflexively judge and categorize others as well as ourselves. That whatever you know, categories we may ourselves belong to, we really need, this is something that's worth exploring, you know, and having, you know, having different experiences with people from, you know, all kinds of categories may or may not help with that. I think it's more something that we can explore about ourselves. So the, and I think this points to actually what the Yogacara Buddhists describe as the second transformation, which is the action of the storehouse consciousness and the manas together, so that we develop a belief based on what we have stored away, what in our experience, we develop a belief that I am thus, or I am this, or others are this, and I have a relationship to others in such a way, and that holding on to ourselves as a fixed, ongoing person with these fixed attributes is the second subjective transformation. The first one is we're storing things. Second one is we're holding on to them and saying, you know, this is who I am. And then the third subjective transformation is our own discrimination of things based on our own discrimination of the new things that are coming at us based on the five senses plus thinking consciousness as they are then influenced by these low, you know, deeper levels of the mind. And so I would argue that maybe this, it helps to understand part of, at least, of why it's so difficult for people to break out of, you know, the cycle of poverty, even though they might be, you know, benefiting from other, you know, actions in their life that are trying to counteract that. It's also difficult to break through what is, in psychology we know of as the intergenerational transmission of trauma, because people are interacting with each other in such a way that it just continues to repeat and perpetuate some of the same relational patterns and behavioral patterns. You know, people, we come to experience ourselves for, as we have for generations, in light of unspoken or unexamined pervasive attitudes. So, you know, what we call the past exerts an influence on the formation of the future, and the future is something that cannot be so easily changed. We are seeing things based on the past, and I think I was quoting Genjo Koan in my previous talk, and I'll quote it again. One of the things that Dogen says is, you know, we see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. And so I think that this is where practice helps us to see maybe a little bit more and see a little bit more about what we ourselves are doing. So I will go on to say that, whatever, as I mentioned earlier, the understanding of the alaya vijnana or storehouse consciousness is that whatever's stored there is there forever. We may have experiences that modify that, but you know, you could even add to experiences that don't support whatever that one particular thing is, but we'll never be completely free of it. Even though you may develop lots of, you know, I think as the article talks about, you may have very conscious attitudes that are very different from some of the experiences that are stored, they never go away completely. And so I think it's, you know, maybe one way of working with that is to continue to examine that, but to also continue to try to have experiences that don't support maybe a particular bias or a particular negative negative experience or memory. It's also true that whatever is not stored in the storehouse consciousness isn't going to suddenly appear in our lives. So, you know, for instance, if we don't build up the potentiality for compassion or forgiveness or for generosity, we're not going to be able to manifest these on demand. So I think these are the implications for, you know, how we live our lives, that what Yogacara Buddhism is telling us, I think, is that we need to continue to try to, you know, manifest positive qualities such as, you know, forgiveness or compassion or care or, you know, even just reflection and awareness, that that, you know, nothing as Dogen would also say elsewhere, you know, nothing is hidden in the entire universe. What is the ways that we live our lives really has significant impact on how we will live our lives in the future and how we will understand ourselves and others and how we will be able to help ourselves and others. In a way that you can't just, you know, sort of cheat or cram for. You can't just suddenly have a sudden turnaround. But at the same time, you know, I think one of the things that is promising is that, you know, almost everyone, I could say everyone, but I don't want to say that definitively, but almost everyone has had some experience of receiving kindness or care or forgiveness, and so can make a choice to, we can make a choice to cultivate these kinds of experiences in ourselves and to continue to try to, you know, look at our biases and look at our, you know, experiences of situations where we believe something negative is happening, to try to view those in a more compassionate way and maybe, you know, bring a little bit more of a compassionate aspect of ourselves to our interactions. It's not, you know, that's not a perfect science either. It's not like we can just sort of change ourselves, but I think that there is a way of, you know, practicing compassion or practicing forgiveness and practicing care and both learning from those experiences, but also, you know, continuing to lay down those experiences. I've known people who have had very, you know, maybe difficult experiences within their families as children who, you know, make a conscious choice to try to find a way to, you know, have better or more positive interactions with others in their daily life and with their children and, you know, kind of make a decision of like, okay, it stops here. I'm going to try to not bring this to my own children or to the people that I encounter in my life. And that, I think, is kind of the main point of what I wanted to bring us to today, that practice that we all have these very difficult and very entrenched ways of experiencing the world that are not always so helpful and not always so positive, but that through practice over time, you know, these can become transformed, not entirely through our conscious actions and intentions, but partly through our actions as we, you know, continue to store memories and create, you know, create experiences that then transform what we think is happening in the present and in the future. So I think that's actually all I really want to say today. I'm hoping maybe we can have a little bit of a discussion on any of that or anything about Yogacara that I maybe touched on very lightly in the beginning. So thank you.
That was a very interesting talk. One of the things that was sort of implicit there, you know, when you were talking about karma, is the way, you know, we think about karma as action. We also think about the way we tend to, the problem with karma is it tends to reproduce a certain kind of unsatisfactoriness of our experience, you know, however narrowly or broadly we want to describe that. And you can see the problem, right? Because, you know, and this test that you talked about, was very interesting that way, because once you are disposed, because of some experience or some thought, to perceive something in a particular way, once you have that, then you're predisposed to see the next thing that comes along in terms of that. And, mm-hmm. say if you have some sort of, say, homophobia planted in you, maybe we talk about confirmation bias, like things that don't match that, are not seen or ignored. Yeah. And things that reinforce that or confirm that or are in accord with the previous thing are taken in. And so then the third thing that comes along, the fourth thing, it's like a rut.
Yeah,
And you get more and more constrained by consciousness in social ways and how I think that would apply to, physical perceptions, all that. So it's a problem.
Yeah.
Could you say more or say more about how practice itself undoes that? What about, do you have any thoughts about how the process of Zazen, say, tends to match that, loosen that up?
I don't know that I'm not so familiar with what anyone else would say about that. I imagine that people have written about this and could say it more articulately than I can, but I'm not so familiar with that. But I would say that I would hope that by just allowing ourselves that space to, on a regular basis, not as a, I'm going to sit down and figure this out kind of way, but that just allowing ourselves that space on a regular basis to observe what's going on in our minds, that those things will kind of bubble up naturally. I feel like that's sort of the whole, understanding of practice in general, and I would hope that it would continue to work on those aspects as well. But I think you're pointing out that we do tend not to see things that don't confirm what we already believe. Sometimes we do, though, and I feel like that is one of the, one of the potentials or one of the promises of practice is that maybe we'll see a little bit more, and so that's what I mean about practice as a process, that, it's something that, we think of ways in which people experience, being transformed over long periods of time. It's not like an overnight kind of thing. Is that kind of your understanding as well?
It is kind of my understanding, but it's very intuitive.
Yeah.
And that's why I asked, because I do feel much the same. And when I sit, I sort of have, or when I think about my time involved sitting, I have a sort of sense of that's kind of what is happening, but I couldn't really say why or how. And maybe it's okay not to say why or how. But if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, the other piece that maybe neither of us have touched on is the idea of working with a teacher, to somebody who we talk to on a regular basis, who can maybe point out things that are coming out in our speech that we're really not aware of, and who can sort of say, you just said X, or what did you mean, when you used that particular word. I think it's something that people experience in psychotherapy, but I think, on a different non-psychotherapy level, I think it's something that people can experience in working with a teacher, just because it is so hard to see what we're doing, just have somebody to observe that, or even, if a formal spiritual teacher is not available or is not something that one wants to pursue, having friends, having sangha that we can talk to about, or having people who can, kindly, that we respect and trust, who can kindly and gently point something out to us, I think is another really important aspect of that. I think Iggy, you were first.
All right. First, I want to say thank you for the talk. And it's a pleasure to have just spontaneously come 6 weeks after that first talk. That's a nice continuation. I really love this subject and have been thinking a lot about the subject, Yogacara, Buddhism, philosophy, and how it relates to racism, sexism, and homophobia. So it's really enjoyable. I felt inspired to talk in response to your question. I think a lot about ways of experiencing the world kind of anew without those conceptual overlays, and something in a community that I practice with, we explore a lot, is in the sitting posture, is just being totally in the body, and experiencing the world non-conceptually, just by being so firmly rooted in the body. And it's from this place that I often notice like tension arising, or various emotions beginning in response to the people I'm with, and then the thoughts often come. So I'm curious about that kind of thought approach of noticing what kind of thoughts are entering your mind when you're around different people, but also in my body, and I'm sensing that something's often happening there first.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Well, yeah, it is a great point, because I think that sometimes there's this sort of less, I mean, I don't know where, mind, body, whatever, but there's this kind of, you know, you have your experiences, then you, things get triggered, and you have these sort of, I mean, for lack of a better word, somatic things, and then there's this elaboration, right, that, for better or for worse.
Yeah,
it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's in this community that I'm, it's in Colorado, so I'm right over there. But,
what can we ask for this?
It's Dharma Ocean. It's a Tibetan Buddhist and Zen kind of mix. But something we work with is like a bodily experience where we're not embedded in concepts, but something I keep noticing is that it hasn't been addressing, you know, racism, sexism, and homophobia in like really subtle levels.
Yeah.
So it's still really tricky.
It does. I wonder if it's maybe something that, you know, maybe it's something that is, you know, really important and inherent to American Buddhist practice because of our cultural, you know, conditions, you know, and the ways in which we're situated at this, you know, place and time. But I think that's a great way of what I want to go back to saying what you were talking about before. I think examining your feelings is another great way. You know, we talk about examining sensations or perceptions, but just that feeling in the body as you have a thought that, you know, that has a feeling associated with it, or, you know, in your daily life off the cushion as you're interacting with a particular person, just trying to be aware of, you know, how you're feeling. I don't know if that's sort of what you're describing. Yeah, okay.
I think so. Because like what you described, there's a feeling that we have that's almost unconscious that we project out onto an object, and then we can't really know the object as it is because it's already come out.
Consciously,
I think that is happening in our bodies and our thoughts, of course, but we're often more aware of what's happening in our thoughts than elsewhere.
Yeah. And the tendency to then characterize a particular person or a group of people in light of that one feeling or that one experience, just as a way of dealing with it or maintaining it or, you know, holding on to it somehow is hugely important. Thank you.
So I was thinking about this deprogramming, or however they characterized it, where they were showing people different connections of images, and thinking that that's such a drop in the bucket when 24/7 we're bombarded with the images that are reinforcing what we don't want to reinforce. I went to see a film the other day, straight out of Compton, because it's been so well renewed. So forth. And before the film showed, they associate what trailers they show you with what movies, and they showed about 10 trailers of the most violent. I never even dreamed of a movie that violent or horrible. I was traumatized by it. And I just want to reinforce the concept you said about Sangha, because I think we can choose to put ourselves in wholesome situations sometimes, and that we need to choose to put ourselves in wholesome situations, and as much as we have control over, we can't control it all, but because it is acting on us whether we want it to or not, mm-hmm. and it's so pervasive and so anti being good, however we characterize what we want. So Sangha is one way, but friends, as you say, or whatever our choices are.
Yeah.
Because you could go and get retrained for an hour, but the other 23 hours that day, it's other cultural experience.
Yeah. Well, even then, now that you're talking about this is not what you said, but not incompatible with it. Even then, a group can become very insular,
yeah.
So that eventually we're all just sort of reinforcing each other's perceptions and like, okay, we're good. And so it's always important to, for all of our sakes, to continue to try to have, positive, caring, loving interactions with all kinds of people whenever possible. And try to bring some, understanding as well. I think one of the things I didn't talk about that I did talk about in the previous talk was recognizing that as much as we have our own negative and painful sometimes conditioning, that makes us, we've got our own little scar tissue everywhere that no one sees, so does everybody else. And so finding ways to have caring interactions with as much as possible. Whatever people we encounter or whatever beings we encounter, I think that heals us as well as them. Or I can't say how I can't speak for anybody else. That's actually not really very fair. I couldn't say how that would be healing for anyone else. But I think it contributes to at least healing in the sense of wholeness. It creates a little bit more. It opens our own eye of practice and experience, and makes us a little bit more whole. And hopefully,
well, if you put
it makes
positive karma out there as far as interaction with people where you smile and you greet people and you recognize them as individuals,
yeah.
I think that cascades.
Yeah.
Maybe that person is in a bad, maybe they don't respond to you, but maybe they do. Maybe they go, I was in a, this person's treating me, kindly, now I can, now I can treat some the next person, what I mean?
Yeah,
and I think we develop the positive aspects of our personality and put it out there, it will grow. Just as if we put negative aspects out there, they will grow.
Right.
So, why not do positive?
Right. Right. And they may not reflect it right away. They may be something that, just they're surprised actually, like, whoa, I didn't expect that from that person.
But it's still positive is still better than negative.
Sure. No, I completely agree. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Dave.
My voice is gone, so I'm going to try that. But a lot of these issues of racism and heterosexism and homophobia and class and gender roles exist for very real economic and reasons of power in our world. It's, mm-hmm. They exist for reasons. And I think I want to echo the sentiments about building community and Sangha and friendship in the largest sense of that, because I think the way in which we really make a meaningful step towards counteracting a lot of those forces is rebuilding communities that have been taken away from us, or rebuilding communities that have never been able to exist before because of poverty or conceptions of racism that have been and plants do this to make power structures possible. So there is some individual work, and Zazen can be helpful in terms of self-reflection and realizing wholeness, but I think to make a meaningful impact on dismantling racism, we have to talk to each other,
mm-hmm.
And talk to folks that are affected by it, and make those connections with communities that, for one reason or another, a lot of structures don't want us to be making connections with, for economic reasons or different reasons of distance in Chicago.
I think that that's true, and as I was reading, you know, some of what I've been reading and reflecting and studying, I've been thinking about, at the same time, you know, different ways that change happens. And we're talking about sort of, you know, the grassroots low-level kinds of changes that we can have on a daily basis. But there are other, you know, it's important to recognize that there are larger forces here, and that, you know, sometimes change needs to happen through protest or through sanctions or through that's kind of what you're highlighting too, right?
I'm not even talking about protests. I'm just talking about in their individual lives that. Like,
oh, okay.
Like in building community, like part that's part of like there a lot of times those elements lead into it where you talk to someone who's grown up and lived on the South Side for their entire life. And what's your experience? What is that like? You know, someone who has, you know, been victim of, or a survivor, I should say, of sexual assault multiple times. What's your experience in learning? You know,
okay.
So it's not even just a protest.
I see.
It's not, you can't just be trapped in your own perspective.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to be a good person. You know, it's like, we have to do the work of talking to each other.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so it's not directly engaging the economic forces, but finding a way to maybe subversively sort of, or subvert those kind of forces to really connect with people. Yeah.
Just talking.
Yeah.
Can you say the name of the book that you mentioned?
Yeah, sure. It is called Living Yogacara by Tagawa Shune and translated by Charles Muller. I think it was like 2009. And I'm sort of slogging through it very slowly. Just because it's because it is very, you know, it's thought-provoking, and I think the really, you know, for me, the way that I understand things is by being able to sort of compare them to, you know, did I have an experience that somehow reflects that? But I really appreciate all of the aspects that everyone here is bringing out with respect to this, too. I think maybe we will wrap up, unless there's one more thing anybody had burning. So thank you very much for coming and for sharing some really important thoughts and discussion. I want to mention a couple of announcements before we wrap up. The first is that next Sunday there will be a half-day sitting from in the morning, and that includes lunch. And then the half-day sitting will be followed, and that will be led by our teacher, Taigen, who will be back in town. That sitting will be followed by a Jukai ceremony, or lay ordination ceremony, for 5 people within our Sangha. That will be in the afternoon. You're welcome to attend the Jukai ceremony, whether or not you come to the all-day sitting and or the half-day sitting and vice versa. That, I think, is around, I don't know, is that 3 p.m.? That'll be here and open to the public. And if you're interested in coming for the half-day sitting, please let me know or send an email to info@ancientdragon. I think there's a little bit more information on flyers out in the front hall. And as a heads up, maybe I'll just mention that we will be having a 3-day sitting in September on the weekend of, I think it's the 16th through the 18th, 19th, and 20th. Okay. And you're welcome to come for 1, 2, or all 3 days. Lunch and dinner on late days will be provided. And I think there's more information on that in the hall as well. Anybody have any other announcements? Yeah.
Well, I think maybe everybody knows that it's important to say that when we have these half-day sittings or three-day sittings, Sunday mornings, the people are welcome to come at the regular time for sitting, even if they're not participating in the retreat.
That is important to say. Thanks.